Morning, everyone. I just came across that during the week and thought you might like it. If you can't read it, it says, for the benefit of anyone listening to the recording, I put up a picture of some people listening to a sermon. Most of them don't seem to be enjoying it very much. And the accompanying text says, there's a fine line between a long sermon and a hostage situation. And it struck me that I don't know how many thousands of sermons I've listened to in my life, but every now and again, one of them was either something which I really felt I didn't agree with or was just plain boring. And I thought, why don't I just walk out? And I never did. And I think that's partly because I didn't want to, you know, offend the preacher, and partly because I couldn't face the people who would come up to me afterwards and say, why did you walk out? If you get the urge today to walk out, please do so, but consider just interrupting and telling me off, which is what we usually do. You know, I'm happy with that. Ah, enough levity. Let's pray. Loving Father, it is a privilege to be part of this community and to be part of the kind of society that we live in. We do thank you that we are able to meet and talk about your teachings. We ask that you will be very present with us. The things that happen here today will be the things that you want to happen. And your will be done in all things. Truly, amen. Okay. I could be wrong. Dot, dot, dot. But maybe not on this occasion. What arrogance. Here's why I might not be wrong on this occasion. And this passage, Matthew 23, has fascinated me for a very long time. I'll go more into that in a bit later. It contains from Jesus some teachings of Jesus. The whole chapter is Jesus' teachings. If you're reading in a red-letter Bible, it's just solid red. It contains some of Jesus' teaching that's really spoken to my heart, but which also seems to me to upset a lot of ecclesiastical apple carts. And there are a few things that I enjoy more than upsetting ecclesiastical apple carts. When I started studying at seminary, I was always very familiar with this passage. And I thought I'd go there and point out to the lecturers and students there what this passage actually said and how important it was and how it upset apple carts. So I did. I did so, and I kept on doing so. People got fed up with me talking on and on about it. And quite a few people were unhappy with what I said about this passage. I remember Brian Harris being seriously unhappy with an assignment that I wrote when I talked about this passage. But he did acknowledge that I had actually argued my case well, even though he thoroughly disagreed with me, and gave me a good mark. I went on to do a master's degree, much to my astonishment. And then to complete the master's degree, I had to write a dissertation, thousands and thousands and thousands of words. I'm astonished looking back that I actually did it, but I had to do it in order to do it. So I proposed that I would actually do this massive piece of work on Matthew 23. My proposal to do it on this passage was accepted, and my supervisor that was given to me was Dr. Evelyn Ashley. Evelyn Ashley is an absolute expert on New Testament Greek. She is also quite a conservative Christian, so she wasn't going to give me any slack whatsoever. I had to focus very much on the Greek text of this in order to do an exegesis, a study on this particular passage for my dissertation. And I said, here's what it says. She pushed back. She was, as I say, a really well, you know, she knew exactly what she was doing. She wasn't giving me any slack, which meant that she was a very good supervisor. And towards the end of the time of us working on this, she says she was looking through, it was almost complete, and she said, Peter, this is a pass. She said, this is definitely a pass. So we were able to hand it on. It had to be marked by somebody who was from completely outside the seminary, and it was marked by a well-known New Testament scholar, Bill Loader, who I'm sure some people here know. Yeah, okay, you've heard of him. He thought it was great. He really liked what I'd written, and he gave it a distinction. So that is why I think I can say, not necessarily that I'm right, because some of these people didn't think that I was right, but I do have good academic backup for saying the things I've said. Not that people say, yes, you're right, but people would say, well, we can't argue with what you're saying. so I could be right. On the other hand, of course, I could be wrong. Context. The context of the way Matthew, I'm just going to refer to the author of this book as Matthew, just to save time. We don't know who it was, but let's call him Matthew. One of the interesting things, sorry, this is an aside, but one of the interesting things about Matthew, the tax collector, who is generally believed to have written this book, is there's a very, very old story, I mean an ancient legend, that Matthew actually wrote down. He, being a tax collector, he was literate. He wrote down the things that Jesus said as Jesus was saying them. And then later they were translated into Greek from Aramaic. Whether it's true or not, of course, we don't know. But it's... I love this book. Okay, the context. On the previous day, Matthew tells us Jesus spent the last few days of his life on this planet in Jerusalem. And on the day before what we're going to be reading today, he entered Jerusalem on the donkey and everybody cheered and the children were shouting in the temple courts. He overturned the money changers' tables and the priests, the chief priests, were very unhappy. They wanted to arrest him but were worried because the crowds thought he was a prophet, which he was. But the next morning, Jesus returned to the temple courts and started teaching, and the priests came up and were trying to trip him up, trying to engage him in conversations. And he started telling them parables about themselves and what a lousy job they were doing. And they knew this. They understood that he was telling these stories against him. So they even more started plotting to get rid of him. So that's the point at which we get into Matthew 23. Suddenly in this conversation that he's having with these people, he turns away from talking to the religious leaders and he addresses the crowds and the disciples. So instead of talking to the religious leaders, he actually starts talking about them to these other people. But the religious leaders are still listening there. We know that at least some of them were still there listening to what he said. And he wasn't very nice. Jesus said to the crowds and his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must be careful to do everything they tell you. Do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach." These bits here, it is not clear what they're talking about. And I often feel if it's not clear, scholars have debated for centuries over exactly what these things mean. What Moses' seat, for example, is, nobody knows, because there's no other reference to Moses' seat in the Bible. There's no reference to it in Hebrew or rabbinic literature. So we just simply don't know what that means. That gives theologians, of course, and scholars lots of options to talk forever about it. But the truth is we don't know, and we're not going to worry about it this morning. Also, with that bit there where it says, you must be careful to do everything they tell you, well, Jesus referred to them as blind guides and criticized their teaching regularly. So it's a bit of a strange thing for him to say, you must be careful to do everything they tell you, when in other places he basically said, no, don't. The last line there, do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach, is quite clear and consistent with other things that he said. Okay, this is going to get more interesting as we go on, trust me. They tie up heavy, cumbersome loads and put them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Again, this passage isn't exactly clear. The scholars can't agree on this one. The obvious thought is that the heavy, cumbersome loads is actually the law of Moses, that they were saying to people, you must obey all 600 points of the law of Moses. It doesn't make sense because it contrasts their willingness to do this, and the religious leaders of that time were absolutely punctilious about keeping the law. So there's something which doesn't quite work in that passage. Some commentators think that Jesus is pointing out the law was intended to be for the benefit of the people, but the priests have made it a burden for them. That makes sense, because he says that in other places. You know, when the disciples were eating grain, and the religious leaders said, oh, they're working. And Jesus said, the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So that is a reasonable. Whatever the loads that Jesus is talking about, it's clear that his criticism of the scribes and Pharisees is that they do not help in any way the people who were burdened by the loads. In other words, they don't serve those people. And this is consistent with Jesus' continual emphasis that the role of attitude, role and attitude of a person who is trying to serve God, is to be one of humble, practical service. Everything they do is done for people to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassel on their garments long. They love the place of honour of banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. This isn't the first time that Jesus has criticised people for doing stuff in order to impress other people. He did it in Matthew 6 when he was talking about people who give alms or people who pray, and they do it in public, and criticised them for doing that. Phylacteries, I presume most people here know phylacteries are little boxes that contain Jewish scriptures, and in the Old Testament law, people are told to bind them on their arms and their foreheads so that they will remember the law. Tassels, in the same way, were a reminder of what exactly? A reminder to keep the commands of God. And you still see some Orthodox Jews, male Orthodox Jews, will wear those little boxes on their heads and wear tassels. The idea, though, is that you do that to remind yourself constantly. These people were making their boxes big and their tassels long in order to impress other people with their piety. And the message for us in that is do things out of love for God and love for our neighbours, not in order to impress others. In the context of what Jesus is saying here is just a little bit about Middle East culture of the time. Personal honour was extremely important for men in first century Eastern Mediterranean society. I'm going to come back to that in a bit, but if you were a religious leader, then honour was very, very important for you. So their place of honour at banquets and the most important seats in the society of that time was very, very important. Jesus is criticising both the behaviour and the motivation of the scribes and the Pharisees. They want to impress others with their piety. They love to be seen in places of honour. They love to be shown respect. They love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to be called rabbi by others. And Jesus is saying to his followers, you are not to be like that. You are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher and you are all brothers. We need to talk for a moment about the meaning of the word rabbi. Words change their meaning over time. The word rabbi these days means an ordained minister in the Jewish church. In those days, it just meant teacher. It was slowly changing in meaning, but in those days, it just meant teacher. But it wasn't a word which meant a teacher. It was how you addressed somebody, and it was giving them honour by calling them teacher. Some people referred to address Jesus as rabbi. So it wasn't anything to do with the priesthood, the established priesthood, but it was definitely an honorific. It was a form of address that showed respect and honor to the person being addressed. And Jesus tells his disciples, knowing that they are going to be taking on his work after he goes, he says, you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher and you are all brothers. Very shortly, he will make it clear that he is that one teacher, if in case there was any doubt. You are all brothers there. Some people who make translations of the Bible where they want to be gender neutral translate that as students. But what Jesus seems to be saying here is you are all equals. Jesus is drawing a line here. And interestingly, he's not drawing a line with himself and the disciples on one side of it and everybody else on the other side. He's drawing a line with himself on one side of it, and the disciples and everybody else on the other side. Remember, he's addressing the crowds and the disciples. It needs to be made absolutely clear that although he's saying, don't let anyone call you rabbi or don't let anyone call you teacher, he is not telling his disciples not to teach. Later on, he made it very clear that he does want them to teach, and he made it very clear he wants them to teach. But he does seem to be setting an absolute boundary between himself and the human race, if you like. I think this is important for his disciples. It was important for his disciples. It's important for us. Remember, the disciples are regularly portrayed as arguing among themselves about who's the best and jockeying for position. And James and John even wanted Jesus to promise that they would have high positions in his coming kingdom. And Jesus regularly says, no, you're not to be like that. You're to be humble servants of each other. Just a little aside, it seems that they got the message, because during my researches on this, I actually went through the New Testament looking for places where one of the 11 actually claimed to have authority over anybody else, and there aren't any. If you find one, let me know. But I could not find one single case where one of the original disciples claimed to have authority over other people in the church. Even Peter, in his letter, describes himself as a fellow elder, and speaking to the other elders, says, you know, you must not lord it over people. Be an example to them, is what he says. Going on with Matthew 23, do not call anyone on earth Father, for you have one Father and he is in heaven, nor are you to be called teachers, for you have one teacher, the Messiah. That first bit there, do not call anyone on earth Father, sounds a bit odd. And again, the experts have continued to debate about precisely what this means. The best that I have heard, the best explanation, is that he's talking about people who have a patron relationship. I'm so sorry, I'm not doing that very well. A young man wanting to get on in the world would try to find a patron, somebody who was already important in society, who had all the things, and that patron would then look after the young man, introduce him to other important people, promote him, tell everyone else what a great guy he was. And it was normal for somebody in that situation to call their patron Father. But it was very much, again, it was a matter of giving the other person honour and respect, which is what Jesus is obviously talking against. This next bit, nor are you to be called teachers, for you have one teacher, the Messiah. Jesus has already said you mustn't be called teachers. So is he repeating himself? No, this is where things get really interesting, trust me. This word teacher here, used in this there and there, is absolutely unique. The Greek word is not used anywhere else in the New Testament, and the Greek word is not used anywhere else in what is called the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Old Testament. It is completely unique. It doesn't occur anywhere else, which was great fun when I was doing my research, because obviously I couldn't compare it with anything in any other use of it in the Bible. I had to go outside the Bible and look at first century Greek documents which use this word to find out how it was being used. There are lots of them, documents and inscriptions still around. And what I found was that it was only, almost nobody, only one person had ever written on it. I was astonished at that. And I was fairly certain that he got it wrong, so I put in my dissertation, only one person has written on this, and he got it wrong. And Bill Loder tended to agree with me. I found that it was only used in secular, not in religious situations. So it was used for teachers of ethics and philosophy and rhetoric and that kind of thing. And they tended to be senior academics that this word was used about. In fact, it's still used in Greek today. The same word is used to mean a professor in a university. Exactly the same word, spelled the same way. So the conclusion I came to in that is that Jesus is to be our only teacher, not just on spiritual matters, but on ethics and philosophy and what we generally call the humanities. Jesus teaches about that. But it's this verse, 30 years ago maybe, long before I thought about going to seminary, this verse, the words, you have one teacher, the Messiah, jumped off the page and smacked me in the head when I was reading it one day, 30 years ago. And my immediate reaction was supposing he meant it, supposing Jesus meant that he was to be our only teacher. What does that say about all the other verses in the Bible, the human beings, Paul, Peter, whoever it might happen to be? And that's what led me along this path of when I got to seminary, saying, listen to this, guys, this is what he says. What does it mean? And getting into all sorts of strife, suggesting, how can I put this? We believe that Jesus is God incarnate. We believe that people like Paul and Peter were human beings. If we believe that the entire Bible is fully inspired by God, then does that mean that the teachings of Peter and Paul are fully inspired by God, human beings, and their teaching is at the same level as the teachings of Jesus, the Son of God? I think, And this is while I went to a Baptist seminary, believe it or not, saying these things. This isn't right. Jesus' teachings have to be put above everybody else's teachings. I can remember some of the debates were furious. I got accused of heresy and a few other things. But one of them was to do with Peter. I used to say, why is it that we know quite a lot about Peter, and we know that time after time after time he got things wrong. Not just when he was with Jesus, but later on he and Paul had a dust-up, and we've only got Paul's account of that dust-up, but it sounds like Paul had good grounds for saying it. So Peter was somebody who kept getting things wrong. Why, I would say, do we believe that God inspired every word that Peter wrote when he quite clearly did not inspire every word that Peter said? These were the debates that went on. And I know I'm in all sorts of trouble with all sorts of people in saying these things, but the important thing is about during the time that I was at Vaux Seminary and I was talking about these things, I was getting feedback from people like Brian Harris, people like Dr. Evelyn Ashley, who were saying, we don't agree with you, but we can't actually argue with what you're saying. And they still don't agree with me.
When you say they don't agree with you, are they saying, from a scholarly perspective, we disagree with your analysis, or are they saying you are attacking one of our core fundamental tenets of our religiosity and therefore we cannot agree with you even though logically you are correct?
I cannot read their hearts. Your question is actually about what they said, of course. It's very difficult for me to answer because we had long conversations and I heard what they were saying, but I did not hear stuff which was convincing. So, you know, I would go for the second one. What was it you said?
So my second one, the first point was, are they disagreeing with you from a scholarly logical perspective or yeah. You are attacking something that I fundamentally believe or is important for me maintaining my sense of religious faith?
Yeah, the second one, yes. I believe that that's right because the debates that went on, I don't know, I found it confusing because the trouble is that is so in Baptist, you know, you could not, if you were Brian Harris, for example, say, you know, I think you're right. It just can't happen. Not without people losing their jobs.
I think that goes to fundamentally what you're saying here is that he's put himself in a position that is greater than, and the text is saying don't.
Yeah. Also, consistency is always important, and what Jesus is saying, he is one teacher, the Messiah, is actually consistent with a number of completely wacky things he said. They would have been wacky if he was just a human being. Heaven and earth will pass away. My words will not pass away. I never say anything that God doesn't give me to say. Those kind of things and quite a lot more, particularly in the Gospel of John. If he was a human being, he was nuts. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But he was consistently saying those things, Rose.
Did they ever talk about how that this was about how they earn their living? Your colleagues at the seminary, yeah. you were basically threatening their way of earning a living.
To a great degree, yes, this is true. No, that. Glenn Brooks did. Glenn Brooks said that to me. Yeah.
Did it come up at Vaux?
No, not unless I raised it. No,
interesting.
Brian's going to be coming and speaking later in the year. You might like to run some of this by him. I'm happy to debate. Yeah. Anyone else? We'll move on. I think this passage really is about humility, and there's a natural break coming, but the next thing that Jesus says is... making that absolutely clear, the greatest among you will be your servant. For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. It wasn't the only time he said this. That's a good place for a natural break, but we've just had a fair chat. Anybody got anything else to say at this point?
You said that none of the original disciples ever put themselves in authority, but Paul definitely did.
Yes, but he wasn't one of Jesus'
No, I know, but what, I'm wondering what's the difference then. Is Paul definitely did and the others did not?
Paul did, and even more obviously, James, the brother of Jesus, did. You're reading in Acts, James, the brother of Jesus, was held to be the, well, acknowledged in Acts to be the leader of the church in Jerusalem. Quite how that happened, we've got no idea. But it was James, the brother of Jesus, not James, the brother of John, who became the leader of the church in Jerusalem. And there's one particular passage where he says, I have decided. Having heard everything they said, I have decided. So he definitely had that view of authority. Yes, no, I mean, and all I'm saying is that of those 11, I haven't found any of them actually saying, this is really important for the church because it's talking about hierarchies. And very quickly, in the towards the end of the first century, beginning of the second century, the church started developing hierarchies. It seems to me that that started to happen after the apostles had gone on, had died off. It wasn't something that they promoted. I could be wrong, but I haven't been able to find anything which indicates that any of the apostles...
Do we have absolutely no idea culturally why James, the brother of Jesus, may have been the one that the rest of the community looked to? No reason.
Apart from things often went in families in those days, and still do indeed, as we know from last night's news, the Murdoch Empire. But no, we don't know. Okay, we're going to go on to, we've got some time, yeah. We're going to go on and look briefly at what is known as the seven woes, which is takes up the whole of the rest of Matthew 23. You'll be pleased to hear I've cut the seven woes down to three. This is because, mainly for time, but I've cut out things which don't seem relevant to us, like swearing by the gold in the temple, those kind of things. You will have noticed that in the POV that the reading was taken from, I made some changes. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites, is the familiar wording of these of the seven woes. And I changed that to teachers of the law and Pharisees, your situation is miserable, you charlatans. There's a difficulty in translation. Always, when I'm trying to translate something, the thing that two things you need to work out. One is, what was the original intent, as much as you can work it out, of the person who wrote the original thing? And the second one, how do I express that in 21st century English? And that one word which is translated woe there is incredibly difficult. There's a translation, according to one expert, the word makes a powerful but imprecise statement about the unhappy situation in which some persons find themselves, whether they know it or not. So that's what the word woe means. How do you put that into 21st century English? Actually, I'm rather surprised. I was thinking about this. I even consulted the other members of my household on this. But surely, if there's one language which would have a powerful but imprecise statement about the unhappy situation in which some persons find themselves, it would be Australian English. Because Australians, you know, tend to have pithy statements which do that kind of thing. Some of them are very rude, of course. Tony? Bugger. Bugger to you, scribes and Pharisees. I think it's getting there. It needs polishing, you know? Yeah, yeah. Any other suggestions without using terribly rude words? Rose?
There's an old Aussie poem called We'll All Be Rude.
Yes, yeah.
We'll all be rude.
You'll be rude, yeah, yeah, yeah. Especially that rabbi called Hanrahan, yes, that's right. Yes, we'll all be rude. Okay, so I translated that, your situation is miserable. That's why I translated it like that. But it doesn't really possibly get the meaning across.
I was just thinking, some people say, I'm stuffed.
I'm stuffed.
Which has got rather impolite roots.
You are stuffed, scribes and Pharisees. I think we're making progress. The word hypocrites. Sorry, Tony again.
Your situation is tragic.
Yes, that's good. I like that. Your situation is tragic. Yes. all of those are in that zone, definitely. Hypocrites is also an inaccurate translation of the Greek. The original Greek word, hypocritus, actually meant an actor, somebody who's playing a part, someone who's wearing a mask. Now you're starting to get the idea. It's not a hypocrite today is somebody who... I've used the word charlatans because that is somebody who's pretending to be something that they're not in order to get gain, basically. As I said, I've reduced the seven woes to three for the sake of time. So the first one, having introduced it with that phrase, woe to you, you hypocrites. You shut the door of the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. It's brutal stuff, isn't it? Jesus is talking, though, to men whose job it is, whose whole position in society is to encourage others to a right, loving relationship with our Heavenly Father. And they're not doing it. They're focused on all the other stuff, on honour, looking the part. You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill and cumin, but you've neglected the more important matters of the law. Justice, mercy and trust. The word I put trust there was originally faithfulness, but it's our old friend pisteo, who we've talked about before, and I think the best translation for that word is trust, trusting God. And this just is, you know, we get it. You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. Okay, summary. Jesus tells us, his followers, to be humble, to accept that they are all equals and no one has authority over others, not to seek honour, not to give honour to each other by addressing each other using honorific titles, and not to do things to impress other people. Anything else? Copies of my 14,000-word dissertation... for a small fee. No, seriously, if you want to read it, I'll send you a PDF, but it's very academic. I don't know how I wrote it, honestly. Anyway, done. Thank you.